This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes, across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's show, I'm going to be talking about The Light Between Oceans, Morgan, The Sea of Trees, Zoom, and the documentaries Germans and Jews and Breaking a Monster. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, you can find me at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First piece of news, and this is actually going to take up the big majority of what I'm going to be talking about, simply because it's a reflection for me, is that we lost Gene Wilder earlier this week. He died on Monday at age 83. Now, a lot of some people in the younger generations don't even know who he is because he really hasn't been actively making movies. He was big in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Actually, the 70s were his heyday, but he also did stuff well into the 80s and the 90s. I grew up with him watching the Mel Brooks movies that he was involved in. The two biggest ones, probably the two most memorable Mel Brooks movies you will ever see, came out within 12 months of each other. He had Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein, and Gene Wilder was in both of those and, in fact, helped write Young Frankenstein, which today still is timeless and exists in a world outside of other cinema because it spoofs and pays homage to the original Universal Monster movies, which at the time were only 40 years old. Now they're like 80 years old. And it did so with such precision and brilliance that this movie is timeless and you can watch it without having it feel like a movie from the 70s, which is a rare thing to have happen. Young Frankenstein was so impactful to me as a young kid, partly because I loved the old Universal Monster movies, and it walked that thin line between paying homage and outright spoofing. We've lost the idea of a spoof movie with the crap that have come out, like Epic Movie and Meet the Spartans. Those aren't spoofs. Those are just gags. It's not as well put together. And even Blazing Saddles, which was a Western, which is a spoof of the Western, but also works completely as a Western itself. And he had a much smaller part in that, but he was very critical to that film. But I think the one that he's most well known for, though, is Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. I even remember when they remade that movie about 10 years ago with Tim Burton, and they brought in Johnny Depp, and I like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the remake, but the original Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, even though Johnny Depp probably got the essence of what Roald Dahl was going for with Willy Wonka, there was something timeless about how Gene Wilder played him. He played him as both a child and somebody who was horribly annoyed with children. And he managed to be crazy and overbearing, but warm and endearing all at the same time. And that was a feat. Now, there are other little films of his that I also loved. I remember watching The Woman in Red. That was one of the earliest PG-13 movies out there, by the way. And he directed that. It wasn't a great movie, but it's one that I remember watching and specifically going to see because Gene Wilder not only was in it, but he was also directing it. And he was in all those movies with Richard Pryor, you know, stuff like Silver Streak and Stir Crazy and See No Evil, Hear No Evil. They were this great comedic pair, and I wish they had done more. And then there's some smaller ones that people forget about, like The Cisco Kid, which he played a rabbi going with a robber out in the Old West, played by Harrison Ford. People forget he was in that movie. Or a movie like Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother with Marty Feldman, which is a hilarious film and kind of a forgotten classic, in my opinion. I remember my sister and I caught it on late night TV when we were like teenagers, and we were howling at this movie. We thought it was hilarious. Also had Madeline Kahn in it. I mean, this whole staple of Mel Brooks' ensemble is gone. Madeline Kahn's gone. Gene Wilder's gone. Richard Pryor, who helped write Blazing Saddles, is gone. Makes me want to go back and watch all those Mel Brooks movies again. So it's sad to see Gene Wilder go. He was 83, and I will miss him, and I will treasure his movies forever. A couple other real quick notes on movie news. Warner Brothers is developing the Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, and of course they want Daniel Radcliffe back. I'll be curious to see if he comes back, because he has spent a long time and very effectively distanced himself from the Harry Potter movies. But, you know, he might do it simply because he hasn't let it define his career, and he's done so much outside of it, even like Swiss Army Man earlier this year. Reminds me a little bit of how Elijah Wood was in the Hobbit movies. He had a little cameo in those, the new Hobbit movies, without, you know, trying to stay away from it. I kind of throw shade at actors who refuse to reprise a role just because they want their career not to stagnate. And, you know, if you have something classic, embrace it and love it. And that's what you should do. And I mean, I don't know if he wants to come back. I mean, there may be scheduling conflicts, but who knows? There's also Terminator 2 is getting a 3D re-release, which is interesting. I mean, it's obviously going to be seeding the Avatar sequels that are coming out soon. But I find it odd that they're doing a re-release for a 3D movie. They haven't done that in a long time. I mean, like specifically re-releasing stuff, like when they did Titanic. The last one I remember was Star Wars Episode 1 as a post-conversion classic movie. Brought back. But I'm interested in seeing it. I'll be curious to see how it translates to 3D. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one is Mr. Church. Actually opens in a couple weeks on September 16th in a much limited release.
Good morning. I see you met Charlie.
Not officially. Lauren Charlotte, my name is Mr. Church.
When Mr. Church came into our lives, I wanted him gone.
I hope you don't mind. I bring books with me every place I go.
I hate reading.
But over time, I couldn't imagine life without him.
What kind of a deal did Richard make with you?
I was asked to cook for you and your child till you passed on.
And through it all, I never knew Mama was sick. I never knew anything until much later.
This is Eddie Murphy trying to get his career back. And he did this about 10 years ago with Dreamgirls, where he tried to get his career back on track and then tanked it again with like Norbit. Eddie Murphy's had a rough time because he used to rule the box office. Back in the days of Beverly Hills Cop, he was like the big star, but he's been struggling to capture it back. I remember a couple years ago he did Tower Heist, where he was trying to go comedy. And actually, I liked Tower Heist. I thought he did a fine job. And then I think Brett Ratner publicly embarrassed himself a little bit more with some of the comments he made around the release of that. And I like Eddie Murphy. I don't like the absolute garbage that Eddie Murphy, when he went sort of down that Adam Sandler road. But you make enough of those crap movies, and then you won't get the big releases anymore. No one's going to hire you, as we've seen with Adam Sandler. I think Pixels was his last hurrah. He's not going to have another big release for a while. He's doing all the Netflix movies. And I think that's where Eddie Murphy doesn't want to go. And so he's trying to get back some street cred by doing a somewhat dramatic role. That opens on September 16th. The next one I want to talk about is A Dog's Purpose. Opens on January 27th.
For me, it all began with a boy. His name was Ethan.
Bailey, 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 Bailey.
My name was Bailey, 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 Bailey. Whenever life got Ethan down, I knew exactly what to do. We spent every day together. As the years went by, I could tell my time with Ethan was coming to an end.
Good boy, Bailey. I'm gonna miss you.
And then it happened. I was back.
Labor Day weekend is notorious for terrible movies, and it never does well in the box office. And generally, September's very weak with movies as well. It's not until you get to October where you get the horror movies, and then you get the holiday movies and the award films. It's generally September and January that have really slow, terrible movies that come out, or it's just they're not big movies. Now, this movie, A Dog's Purpose, is coming out in January, but I gotta say, and it's an easy sell on me because I love dogs, but it looks like a real sweet movie. I mean, it looks just adorable. And as creepy as the trailer sounds, if you don't realize Josh Gad is playing a dog, it actually really seems to connect. It looks like it's going to be one of those, aww, tearjerker kind of movies. Because it's about this dog who kind of reincarnates, and his purpose is to just help other people and make them feel better. And, you know, it's corny. But it looks like it's going to be a sweet movie. So I'll welcome January for this movie. And that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Morgan and the Sea of Trees. Because we can! Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, getting ready to leap right into the movie reviews. Now, like I said earlier, September, and specifically Labor Day, tends to be a slow time for movies. That doesn't mean that there are few movies out. In fact, January and September, I sometimes have the largest slate of movies to cover because there's a lot of smaller releases and documentaries or something like that that I haven't had a chance to highlight in the last couple weeks. Or there's just a lot of stuff going into limited release or on demand that is worth looking at. Whereas in the summertime, you know, everyone gets out of the way for the big tentpole releases. So we tend to have more movies, which is why I'm covering six films this week instead of just, three or four, like I did a couple weeks ago. The first one I want to cover is an anomaly, and I'll explain why in a minute, but let's just play the trailer. It's Morgan, in which a group of scientists are trapped in a lab with a genetically engineered and very dangerous child.
This is Lee Weathers from corporate.
I'm just looking for some information about Morgan.
Morgan was our third attempt, our little breakthrough.
It's the next step in evolution. It's bioengineered with synthetic DNA.
Within a month, walking and talking. Within 6 months, it exceeded our wildest expectations.
I'd like to discuss the incident, if that's okay.
First of all, this wasn't screened for me. Well, it was. I mean, it was screened very limited. And you get that with, especially with 20th Century Fox, they've pulled back on where they screen movies and they go for just the bigger markets. Now, I live in Columbus, Ohio, which is right dead center in the middle of the state. And Cleveland had a screening for it. I was invited to it, but I have to drive 2.5 hours to get to Cleveland, which isn't always convenient. And I go up there sometimes, but it just wasn't in the cards this time. I thought, oh, I'll just catch it on the Thursday previews. Because one of the things they do now that they didn't do even 15 years ago is you have a lot of movies opening on Thursday night. They used to just open them at midnight if they're going to be a big release, because then technically that's a Friday. But now they just open them at, like, you see movies at 7. I've seen movies as early as 4 or 5 on the Thursday that don't even open in technically until the next day. And that's great. The reason they can do that is because of digital projection, by the way. It used to be you had to have a unionized projectionist to actually run the film print. And to have them stick around until 2 or 3 a.m. for a late night movie at midnight was very expensive. Well, this is a push button system, so they can just have any idiot go in there and push the right code into the box and it should project the movie properly. And it doesn't always, but for the most part, it works. And so now you can see any movie, almost any movie, the night before it technically opens. And that works out great for me, because then I can see films and I have to have them reviewed, say, on a Friday morning on radio. Well, Morgan, they didn't have Thursday previews, which is usually a bad sign anyways, because everything shows. I mean, the other big movie, The Light Between the Oceans, that showed Thursday nights, and it's not like a midnight movie. But Morgan wasn't shown, and the only time I've ever seen that happen really is either really, really tiny, small releases, or if it's like a kids movie, because kids aren't going to, they didn't do that with the Peanuts movie, because, you know, kids aren't going to go see the Peanuts movie on a Thursday night in November. Or if it's a movie that they're trying to hide. They don't want people to either talk about because they don't want the word to spread that it's a bad movie, or they don't want spoilers to be dropped on social media. Who knows? this looks like the kind of movie I gravitate to. I mean, it's a movie about people in a lab trying to better humanity and then having it go disastrously horribly awry. I love those films. They had one out a couple years ago called The Lazarus Project, and it was a crappy movie, but I enjoyed it because that's the kind of movie I like. I remember Splice, one of my favorite movies of like 2011, was essentially that, you know, something going terrible. Rise of the Planet of the Apes, another movie about a lab experiment gone horribly awry. I love those kind of movies. They speak to me for some reason, partly because, you know, you sit there and watch these movies and go, what do you, you know, this could go wrong. You know, you're creating a super being. Why? Why would you create a genetically superior being that then could take over the world? That's just, that seems like a dumb idea. It's like artificial intelligence. There was another one, that Transcendence, the one that came out with Johnny Depp. And I actually did a roundtable on NPR once about that movie, about artificial intelligence, and is it a good idea? And I remember talking to one of the scientists as we were leaving. We were chatting as we're walking to the cars, and he's like, oh yeah, you know, some people think that this is a great idea, but it's not. You could easily create a monster and that it could take over the world. I mean, the extreme cases of like Colossus, the Foreign Project, or Terminator 2 are the great examples. So yeah, I mean, I kind of want to see Morgan. I've watched the trailer. I think it looks cool. It looks thrilling. It looks, it's a good old R-rated horror. I'm sure it's predictable and cheesy, but, you know, also the girl from The Witch is in this, and she's a fashion model, and she's, this is the second movie this year where she's sort of in a horror vein playing something very off type of what you'd expect a fashion model to gravitate towards. But I still have to give Morgan a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Sea of Trees. Directed by Gus Van Sant, a man heads into the Japanese suicide forest after personal tragedy hits his family.
The MRI detected a small mass.
How risky is the surgery?
It's a highly invasive procedure.
You believe in God?
I'm a scientist.
God is more our creation than we are his.
If God is not waiting for you on the other side, who is?
All the anger and the pretending and the fighting, it all got put on hold.
It is during our darkest times that our loved ones are closest.
This stars Matthew McConaughey, and Ken Watanabe is in it. He plays somebody he meets in the suicide forest, and Naomi Watts plays his wife. Now, it's all told in flashback. It's sort of very stream of consciousness. It starts off with him going to the Japanese suicide forest, which is a real place. And they actually made a movie out of it early in January, came out called The Forest. This one's not a horror movie, but it's about this. There's literally this forest that people go to die in Japan. I mean, it's not a horror movie out there. And that's, I think, one of the things that I think is most interesting is you had The Forest come out this January, and now you've got The Sea of Trees, which use the same location, but they have very different approaches to it. And this one, I think, is a little more respectful to Japanese culture and what the purpose of the forest is and what people find out there. This isn't my kind of movie. It's very emotionally wrought. And it does wring its hands a lot. The performances are good. I mean, McConaughey's doing fine, and he's trying to keep a legitimate career after winning the Oscar. And, you know, he's no longer doing the sexy romantic comedies with Kate Hudson anymore. He's trying to become that serious actor and continue that career path. And, you know, good for him. This may not be his greatest step towards that, but, you know, at least he's doing something a little bit different, and I can certainly appreciate that from him. Still, the movie does drag a bit. It is very deliberate, and it just drips in emotion. And I'm not a huge Gus Van Sant fan. I was not a huge fan of Good Will Hunting. I've never seen, like, My Own Private Idaho. I'll never forgive him for remaking Psycho. So I have a lot of baggage when it comes to Gus Van Sant. But this movie works to a degree, but it's not great. The performances really elevate it. It's a bit predictable. Ultimately, I'm going to have to say The Sea of Trees. While it's interesting, if you really want to see sort of that acting performance by Naomi Watts and Matthew McConaughey, this is the movie for you. Otherwise, you know, you could skip it and check it out on video. But still, I'm going to have to say the Sea of Trees kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Light Between Oceans and Zoom.
Open Gangnam Style. Gangnam
Style. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Yeah.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's continue with the movie reviews. The two I want to hit in this segment, first one is The Light Between Oceans. After World War I, a couple stationed at a remote lighthouse struggle with having a child until a baby is shipwrecked on the shore.
Can't just be a coincidence that she showed up.
She's a lovely baby, but you can't keep her.
She needs us. We're not doing anything wrong.
What's your name?
Lucy.
Lucy, it was lovely to meet you.
Hi.
Hi.
My sister had a terrible tragedy. Her husband and their baby daughter were lost to the sea. You would have been your girl's age by now.
I'm going to start off, not necessarily even talking about the movie, but talking about the director. This is the guy who directed Blue Valentine and The Place Beyond the Pines. Neither of which movies I liked. In fact, both of those movies I counted as the worst of the year, even though they were being heralded as brilliant films, and Blue Valentine got a ton of awards. These were epically boring films, and in particular, well, even Blue Valentine, but in particular The Place Beyond the Pines, it was all these characters that I hated. I didn't find them appealing. I didn't find them sympathetic. I did not want to spend time with these characters. One of the things you got to do when you make a movie, you have to want to exist in the same universe as these people. Now, and sometimes you can take an unlikable character and make them very fun. I mean, great example are gangsters. I mean, I'm not even talking like The Godfather, because The Godfather, you've got Michael Corleone is sort of a good guy, and he gets corrupted over the course of the three movies. But especially in the first movie, The Godfather, he's motivated by good things. But if you look at like Goodfellas, all the characters are horrible people, murderers, violent felons, but you like them. And you can do that with movies. When you have a movie like The Place Beyond the Pines, which is about basically just a bunch of white trash people who can't get their lives together, and Blue Valentine is the same way, I can't enjoy watching it because I don't care if these people succeed. And that was one of the problems last week I had with Hands of Stone. Hands of Stone was a movie about just a unpleasant person. And I had a friend, Ed Douglas. He commented on one of my statements on social media, and he says, probably most boxers' stories are kind of like the Roberto Duran story. And I'm like, yeah, that's why the fictional ones work best. You know, something like Rocky, you could get behind Rocky because this was a guy who was just trying to go the distance. And yeah, he was doing it in a violent fashion. But the character of Rocky Balboa is a likable character. And that's the problem that I had with Blue Valentine and The Place Beyond the Pines, is I didn't like the characters. And if I don't want to spend time with these characters, why would you want to spend 2 hours in a movie theater with them? Now, I liked The Light Between Oceans, not knowing that it was by this director. I liked it better than his other movie. So it's probably a great film. But I still wasn't a big fan of it. It's very weepy. It's very heavy. It drips in the drama. I mean, not inappropriately overly dramatic. It's just overly dramatic. And it's not something that I particularly enjoyed. Now, with that said, both Michael Fassbender and Alicia Vikander do wonderful performances. And Rachel Weisz is in it as well. And she does a really strong performance. But it's one of those movies where the characters just make some colossally stupid decisions. And I mean, what's interesting is at the very least, they justify why you would handle things differently then, because it takes place post-World War I. This film also shows that, you know, social services back then weren't what they are now. I mean, nowadays, if you're working at a remote lighthouse and a baby shows up on the beach, you should be calling the authorities, because the whole thing is, they said, well, maybe we can adopt her. Like, they'll never let her come out here. It's too remote. They won't let us have her. Let's just pretend she's ours. And she actually gives a good, the character gives a good explanation of why they would want to do this, make this choice. It's still a stupid choice, because you know it's going to come back to haunt you, and the guilt that they feel wrecks their lives and it wrecks their marriage. And it's supposed to be a movie about love, and it's a movie about two people who are in love, and they do something not bad, but just the wrong thing, and they make the wrong decision, and they're stuck with it, and there's no easy way out of it. And so there's a certain reality to the movie. It's just, it's so long, and it's boring, which is this director. That's the way he does things. And in fact, the first half is less narrative and more sort of this patchwork mosaic of imagery, and it felt like a Terrence Malick movie, the first half. Second half gets much more narrative, but ultimately, it's just not my kind of movie. My mother-in-law would probably love it, but I'm going to have to say The Light Between Oceans kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Zoom. No, this is not the Tim Allen movie about a superhero academy. That came out about 10 years ago. This is a very small, low-budget film. If you can't find it locally, which you may not, it's on demand this week. It comes out this week on demand. And in the film, three interwoven stories feature a comic book artist facing body image issues, a filmmaker trying to reconcile art and success, and a model who wants to write a novel retreating to Brazil.
So who is he?
He's hot, stylish, suave. He's my dream man.
You think you're so perfect.
Are you Edward Dicken, the director?
I've never done this before.
Take this.
What is this all about?
How can he know?
Do you think it's funny?
You're just a part of my imagination.
Don't you see what's happening?
I heard people describe this as a comic book movie, and it's really not. I mean, yeah, Alison Pill plays a woman who's an aspiring comic book artist. And so she creates this comic book, and this character in the comic book that she's drawing has his own story, and that's animated in sort of this rotoscoping type of animation. You've seen this kind of thing in like A Scanner Darkly. It's sort of that rotoscope animation overlaying real people. And that's really the closest. It's not a superhero movie. I think people misread the name Zoom and they see it as a comic book movie and they think superhero. There's so much more to comic books. And anyone who knows comics knows that superheroes is just a teeny tiny sliver of what is out there in comic book form. And in fact, most underground comics and independent comics aren't these fantastical worlds anyways. There's a lot of them that are just very real life studies, but they take place just in drawings rather than, because that's how somebody can tell a story. You don't need to have superheroes to have a comic. And I think this kind of shows it. This guy kind of has this provocative life, but there's nothing in his world that is supernatural completely. Overall, I was annoyed with the comic book story. I was annoyed with the Brazilian model going home story, because movies about filmmakers already annoy me, and movies about writers annoy me. And both of those are writers and filmmakers, and comic book artists, same thing, but there's something weird and interesting about the characters, Alison Pill and Tyler Labine, who play the real world artists drawing the comic book. They have such a, they work in a sex toy shop that makes these things, and then she has these body issues, so she gets a breast augmentation. They're too big because she just goes overboard with it and then has to deal with that. Then that defines her, when she's normally been just kind of this mousy girl. So it does juggle a lot of issues and a lot of ideas, no pun intended. So, but the way it links the stories together actually is kind of interesting, and the presentation and the revelation of how things are linked together is actually what made the movie pop for me. It doesn't quite hold together in the final act. It's like they didn't quite know how to end this movie, but it gives it an A for effort in trying to get there. So it's a bizarre movie. It's very hard to talk about without giving anything away, but Zoom is worth checking out if you really want to see something alternative. If you like that sort of that 90s independent film, that's the kind of stuff you get with this movie, only with a little bit more modern sensibilities. So I'm going to have to say Zoom kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the documentaries Germans and Jews and Breaking a Monster. Then I'll also talk about the box office and the home cinema roundup.
Shake that.
Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies for the final segment and the last two movies I'm going to be reviewing. These are both documentaries, and the reason I'm covering them is at the Gateway Film Center in Columbus, Ohio, which is where I live. I don't live in the Gateway Film Center. Sometimes I feel like I do, but I live in Columbus, Ohio, and in the Gateway Film Center, which is an independently run theater that has some real great selection. They play a ton of stuff, and not just the big art house stuff. They do specialty programming, horror, documentaries. They're having a doc week coming up, and these are a couple movies that are going to be presented during them. And the first one I want to talk about, these both have come out recently, and documentaries don't run the same release cycle as the big features. They tend to roll out city to city and sometimes trickle in through, take a year or so to trickle in through the rest of flyover country. And you can find them on demand. Then you can find them on video store shelves or in on streaming sites. The first one I want to talk about is Germans and Jews. This documentary examines how Germans and Jews living in Germany deal with the memories and history of the Holocaust.
I think it is true that most Germans now understand their past and the horror that they visited upon the world. But that's a very hard thing. And to find ways around to explain it is a natural human response.
You always find something where Germans are struggling with themselves and with their history and with their identity. And the same is true also for Jews living here.
One of the things I said to one of the programmers at the Gateway Film Center after seeing this is, I said, what's neat about this movie is it's the first film I've seen about the Holocaust that kind of was uplifting. I mean, the Holocaust was a horrible thing that happened. The Holocaust is tragic and heartbreaking and at times hard to believe that humans did what they did. And I've seen a lot of movies about the Holocaust, some good, some bad. Some great, but they all tend to be very depressing because the Holocaust itself is depressing. This isn't about the Holocaust. This is about not the sides, but the two groups, people who are German and people who are Jewish, especially Jews living in Germany, dealing with this and knowing either what happened to their family who got killed or people who were either complacent or even perpetrators of it, knowing that your grandfather or your great-grandfather was somehow involved. And there's a certain message to this that says, no, we should never forget. True. But we do need to move on. You cannot have the Holocaust, and you shouldn't have the Holocaust, a giant time of victimization for an entire group of people. You can't have that continually define that group of people for the rest of time. There should be the appropriate monuments and there should be the appropriate history, but it shouldn't be the only thing you focus on. And I think that's a very healthy message. It's interesting. I traveled to Jerusalem a couple of years ago to cover the Jerusalem Film Festival. And I saw a lot of Israeli filmmaking. And I found that there are really three things that were basically everything that was made in Israel. It's either the Holocaust, dealing with the Holocaust, and the blowback or the history of... So there's a lot of films about the Holocaust. There's a lot of films about the two-state solution, Israel and Palestine. And then there's also a lot of films that were about the loss of tradition. Israelis and Jewish culture doesn't let the Holocaust drop, and they shouldn't. But there is a certain level of you don't want to dwell on it. You don't want to be defined by that, and you don't want it to be the only thing you deal with. And this movie shows that there are Jews returning to Germany. And actually, they make a point, and they say this in the movie, that some people suggest that it's safer to live in Germany than it is in Israel, although Israel's pretty safe. I mean, you're surrounded by people who want to kill you, but you've got it well protected. I'm going to have to say, this is worth checking out. If for anything, just something that looks ahead towards the future instead of dwelling on the past. Germans and Jews, rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Breaking a Monster. Three African-American kids from Brooklyn take the recording world by storm with their heavy metal band, Unlocking the Truth.
I know him since I was 4. We met at a birthday party. I asked him, do you want to start a band?
Next thing you know, we were out in Times Square, and I knew all these songs.
Big news out of the music industry. Metallica's asked them to open for them.
Three African-American kids from Brooklyn who are a heavy metal band. I was on the plane the next day.
What are you doing out there?
When Disney did the Hannah Montana concert movie and the Jonas Brothers concert movies, those are done for the fans. Those were done as a marketing piece for the bands. And that's fine. Disney's a marketing machine, and they do that very well. What's interesting about Breaking a Monster is the guy who apparently was responsible for bringing the Jonas Brothers to Disney and making them famous, he takes on these three kids who are basically doing a heavy metal band. And they're not Disney kids, because you're not going to see them on a Disney show. That doesn't fit the Disney message. But what's neat about this is you see sort of these untouched youth, these kids who are still very naive and young, and they haven't gotten cynical about the record industry and about music and about performance in general. So you see their excitement, but you also see the management of them, not just this guy who manages them. And the struggles he's doing to get them to do the business stuff that they need to do, the boring stuff that adults do, but also to see how the record company manages them, which doesn't always make the record company look good. And you can totally see from a sense that's supposed to be a somewhat nice way of looking at these record executives and these people who work at a record company and recording studios. And you realize this is how artists are taken advantage of. And it's revealed, and they're not being taken advantage of here, but you can see where this level of power and influence can easily be abused and can easily obfuscate where the money is going. And you hear always about these artists who have best-selling albums and go on tour, or they go on tour, but they still haven't cut an album. For whatever reason, they're being yanked around by the record companies and the recording industry. And you see how that's happening, and all in the guise of this is how it's done, but they are still managing a property. And artists aren't property. Artists are artists. And there's this chasm between the artistic and the business end. And the business end can be very condescending and treat them like a commodity. It's not what you'd expect when you said it's about three black kids from New York getting into the music industry. You're going to think, oh, rap. Yeah, because that's what people always think. I mean, that's what people immediately you think is, oh, Straight out of Compton. You're going to get another one of those. Nope. Heavy metal band. And that's kind of cool. And that's what makes these kids unique. So I'm going to say Breaking a Monster rocks as well.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Don't Breathe won the weekend, as I predicted, with over 20 million. I said 20 million plus. It made like 26 million, which is great, because that shows that there was a good hold for the movie. Now, a lot of people don't realize this, but horror movies tend to be very front-loaded and do very well on their first night or so. But when you finally get through the weekend, they don't hold well on, like, Sunday, for example. that shows that Don't Breathe certainly has power. I mean, it only barely dropped from Friday to Saturday. And even then, it only suffered like 30-some percent drop from Saturday to Sunday, which is an incredible hold. And it's because of those numbers that I think that Don't Breathe is going to win again this weekend over these newcomers, because I don't think Morgan's got the power that Don't Breathe has, and it's a little, you know, already you had the horror movie, and The Light Between Oceans is a very specifically marketed piece. The other stuff is like Mechanic Resurrection came in number 5, Southside With You was 14, and Hands of Stone was 16. These movies did not have a huge box office, and that was to be expected. I think you're going to see the same thing. I think Don't Breathe's going to be around 10 to 15 million for the 3 or 4 day. 10 to 15 million for the 4 day, and I think it's going to hold better and top the box office. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The big one this week is The Jungle Book. That is Jon Favreau's updated version of Disney's classic animated film, which is a fantastic movie. I don't want to say it's live action, because it just looks live action, but everything's computer generated except the kid. It's a gorgeous movie. It's pretty harrowing. It can be intense for younger viewers, but it certainly is a great adaptation. It did extremely well this summer, and it's now available on DVD and Blu-ray. Totally worth checking out, buying for the kids, and enjoying it, keeping it as part of your collection. There's also Me Before You, which I hated, so I'm not even going to bother talking more about that. The Night Manager, which was a John le Carré adaptation on one of the cable stations. It's okay, but it's very deliberate and slow and sort of like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy in that sense. Then there's a whole slew of TV on DVD. You've got Star Wars Rebels Season 2, Arrow Season 4, Shameless Season 6, and Chicago Fire Season 4 with Chicago Med Season 1. They're expanding that franchise. That's it for the show. I need to go enjoy my cookout. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Sully, The Disappointments Room, and When the Bow Breaks. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.